Senate Judiciary Committee, Friday, May 10th, 1991.
We have members who are going to be additionally 20 minutes late. We have a long series of bills on work session today. It would be my intent that we start then, since till we get our full complement of members here, that we go ahead. We've got Mr. Anderson, who's from out of town, needs to get back to Redmond. So let's take up 2382. This is a House bill, the first hearing we've had. And so let's take a moment here to get. We will then take up House Bill 2530, and hopefully by that time we can kind of get into our work session. But I don't want to start the work session until we get our full membership here. Number of bills. Okay, and we do need sign-up sheets when you get a chance. 2382. Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Senator Cohen. Committee members, my name is Bruce Anderson. I'm an attorney from Eugene, and I'm here on behalf of the International Law Section of the Oregon State Bar with speaking on behalf and in favor of a bill that the International Law Section has proposed, House Bill 2382, the Uniform Transboundary Pollution Reciprocal Access Act. This legislation was uniformly supported by the House Judiciary Committee and passed the House unanimously and is before you now. I'd like to just give you a quick summary of the bill. I have extensive written testimony. I'm not going to go through that in detail, especially in light of the length of your agenda today, and would encourage you to feel free to ask questions after I do about a five-minute summary. This legislation was originally proposed by the Uniform State Law Committee of the United States and its comparable committee in Canada. It is not a plaintiff's or defendant's bill. It is an attempt to plug a very important hole in a jurisdictional setting that results from interstate or international pollution. The most important thing for you to realize about this bill is it grants no jurisdictional rights to an out-of-state plaintiff, none, zero, unless the place of that person's residence, the state, or in the case of Canada, the province, adopts the same or substantially identical legislation that would grant in reverse to an Oregon resident the same jurisdictional access to their courts, be they state or Canadian courts. So nothing is granted jurisdictionally by this bill unless the place from where the plaintiff comes has the same legislation in place that would give the same opportunity to an Oregon resident. The purpose of it is to make certain that if there is multi-state or multinational, international pollution that damages someone in another locale and another source, that they have a forum to get a remedy, a redress of that pollution for personal injury and property damage. As I state in detail in my written testimony, the Oregon long-arm statute in its most liberal interpretation could not safely be construed to grant jurisdiction under a number of circumstances where there is no substantial contact or connection or purposeful direction in the United States Supreme Court analogy of efforts by this defendant from another locale to Oregon, for example. The greatest pathway of that in Oregon's possibility for an Oregon resident not having a remedy would be something that originates in Canada on the Columbia River, for example. Since the Columbia flows our way, we're more apt to get pollution from that source harming an Oregon resident and having an Oregon resident not having a full remedy available to them. I've also explained why, under full faith and credit type analogy, a Canadian court, in the absence of such legislation being adopted in a Canadian province, would most likely not give full faith and credit to an Oregon court's determination on that point because of Canadian case law and statutes. That's addressed here. Also attached to my testimony are copies of the Canadian Uniform Conference on State Law background testimony on this legislation and why Canadian lawyers support this and point out that American court decisions would not in the absence of this legislation, get that treatment in Canada. This is a fairness bill. It's a fairness of access bill. As I said, it doesn't give benefits to one party or another, and it just plugs a hole, a jurisdictional hole that could be present. And finally, it gives nothing to anyone who's an out-of-state resident who might come to Oregon and seek jurisdiction of an Oregon court based on this legislation for an injury that occurred in a foreign state or in a foreign country from a pollution source originating in Oregon, unless that state or province has adopted substantially the same identical legislation giving an Oregonian the same rights in reverse in that setting. So you're giving nothing without receiving the same thing by adopting the bill. Just as both uniform state law committees in both countries have supported it, both nations, the international law section of the Oregon State Bar strongly supports it and urges your adoption. I'd be glad to answer any questions. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Shoemaker.
I just want to be sure that this does not, it's not intended by this legislation to create a cause of action that doesn't now exist.
That is correct.
The reason I raise that question is that Section 3 says that a person in a reciprocating jurisdiction may bring an action for injury or threatened injury, mm-hmm. and a person or property in the reciprocating jurisdiction, there are not a whole lot of causes of action available for threatened injury.
Those are typically injunctive type reliefs where there's some substantial injury threatened and the court is asked to stop it from occurring in advance. That's the threatened injury setting. And you're right, there are only certain circumstances where injunction will be granted when something is certain to happen and maybe of a tremendous magnitude or otherwise.
But I could see some lawyer arguing that this bill, if it becomes law, would says that you may bring an action for threatened injury, therefore I am bringing an action under this law. It gives me a cause of action, which I otherwise wouldn't have.
Senator Shoemaker, that concern, I would understand it, and I would urge you to look at Section 5, because it makes very clear that the law to be applied in an action or proceeding brought under this statute is the law of Oregon as it presently exists, including Oregon's choice of law rules. And there isn't anything in here that would create a new interpretation of when an injunction is available or not available in Oregon to the extent it's not present in Oregon's law. And there are circumstances where you can, under Oregon law, enjoin threatened serious injury, but they're very limited. But this doesn't set up any list of new ones or anything else. It wouldn't create any new law in that area.
And finally, what extent has counterparts of this bill been enacted in other states or in our neighboring states and
there are
nearby provinces?
If I could just get my briefcase for a minute, I can answer that specifically.
Okay.
The legislation is being considered in.
Go ahead, please.
Excuse me. The legislation is being considered now in a number of states. It has been enacted into law in five states: New Jersey, and very diverse states too. New Jersey, Michigan, Wisconsin, Montana, and Colorado, by statute. There are two Canadian provinces that, as of today, have adopted it formally into law already. That's Prince Edward Island and Manitoba. But it's being considered in other Canadian provinces and in many other American states presently.
Thank you.
Senator Hill.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned, as a practical matter, you mentioned the Columbia River as being a source of pollution that would come from there to here. From what about the other way? Is there really any... What are the possibilities of us polluting their environment?
Well, as we've learned in the acid rain setting in the east, for example, there can be things that are airborne that can cause pollution. We have, during a portion of the year, prevalent air flows in Oregon that are from the southwest to the northeast. So, you know, it's possible that those air flows could carry some source of pollution to a neighboring state or to another country. That would be one way. We also have times of the year when the prevalent airflow is from the north, so the result could happen during that time. So there are any number of ways in which pollution can be carried through natural sources, and the extent to which those natural sources, be they rain, water, rivers, streams, flow, then those pathways can be the sources of pollution.
I'm sure. Yes, were any of the Oregon business interests involved in when you all proposed this legislation?
Well, the international law section, most of the lawyers who are on that section are business lawyers. I mean, the primary part of my practice is business law, for example. So to that extent, the section itself is made up primarily of business lawyers.
Were their concerns mainly environmental concerns, or were they... I'm just trying to understand.
No, most of them have no substantial environmental law practice. One of the reasons I've been asked to testify is I do some environmental practice as part of my practice as well. The principal reason for supporting this legislation has been the amount of controversy that has developed internationally and among states about this single hole in jurisdiction, that sometimes you can have... usually arises around a big incident that nobody expected, like the two large oil spills in the Ohio River system, where you have these multi-state spills that affect drinking water and so on, all up and down the Ohio River from a source. When you have those kind of things is when, and they don't happen very often, fortunately, but it's when you have one of those that these holes, jurisdictional holes, show up. And it's recognizing that, unfortunately, we live in a world where more and more of those incidents are apt to occur, that lawyers both in Canada and the United States, as well as lawyers among states, have said, you need to be prepared for these few incidents that when they happen, because they tend to have large magnitude when they happen, and you need to not have that hole there so that somebody who is injured has no effective forum to go to seek relief. And that's why this bill is there. And I talk about, like, the law, for example, on injury to property. Normally, without this type of legislation, for example, if you were before a Canadian court and you had property injured in Oregon, Canadian court would say, well, we don't have any jurisdiction to adjudicate property rights in Oregon. We don't have that jurisdiction. Or an Oregon court in the reverse setting with a Canadian would say the same thing. Well, then you have somebody whose property may be substantially injured by interstate or international boundary pollution, who has no effective place to get a remedy.
I see.
And so that's what this legislation is designed to do, but only if the place where the plaintiff comes from has adopted the same legislation as this.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thanks very much. I'd ask you to just wait another 5 minutes or so in case we need you back here. We have Mr. Whitty who might want to respond or ask some questions or
certainly
whatever, and then thank you. And then we have Representative Shiprock in a few minutes on his bill. But why don't you, Mr. Whitty, come on up? We'll finish up on this one.
I am Jim Whitty of Associated Oregon Industries. I want to apologize to the committee. I didn't discover this bill until a couple of days ago, and I think a lot. Most of the members of the business lobby that I've talked to have discovered it just yesterday. So we're a little slow, and I apologize that we did not testify on the bill in the House. I'm a member of the Bar, Oregon State Bar. I did not have a trial practice when I was in private practice. So I really only have questions. I don't have answers or definitive statements. As I recall, civil procedure, when you have a diversity of citizenship, I believe you have a federal court as a possibility, and in which case there is a place to go if the cause of action exists. I don't have any idea how Canada fits into this, and there may be some room for exploration there. So really what we're talking about is access to the state courts, and having more cases brought in the state of Oregon than we have now. And that's really what it comes down to. Do we want to add additional cases to the court system in the state of Oregon. I believe that is correct. I would be willing to talk about whether that's incorrect or not, but that is our chief concern.
Okay. Are you also concerned that an Oregon business corporation working, you know, operating in Oregon might be, who might be allowing them to be sued by some out-of-the-country Canadian-type individuals?
This does open a potentially a whole plethora of actions that we can't even imagine. And if the act were to be expanded to other jurisdictions, it's a big first step to take. Yes, we are concerned about that.
Okay, I would ask that you kind of get a list of the questions circulated around, and then maybe either be in touch with Mr. Anderson or the various other parties and see if there is a matter of clarification or if the questions can be answered satisfactorily, and work with Mr. Taylor and see what you think about it. We're certainly not going to take a work session on it today. And finally, I guess I'd give Mr. Anderson, since you're off to Redmond in a moment, either if it's satisfactory to sort of work informally and answer questions, that's fine. If you want to step up for 30 seconds now to respond, you're welcome to do that. And then we're not prepared for a debate, but I just...
Sure, we'd be happy to work with Mr. Witte and address his questions. I'd urge him to look at a copy of our testimony, because I think a number of the questions that he's addressing, especially the first one about jurisdiction, is addressed in the testimony itself. The other thing that I'd say is that these bills have not produced a plethora of case filings where they've been introduced.
Well, but you probably don't have much in the way of reciprocal agreements in line to date anyway, so... That's not necessarily a good measure at the moment.
Perhaps not totally definitive. That's true until you have that in place. And until you have it in place, wherever the plaintiff comes from, the plaintiff isn't going to get any opportunity to come to Oregon anyway. So it's only where that other states have full opportunity to do this, not just Canada. The other state or province has adopted the same or substantially identical legislation under this. If it doesn't, if they haven't, then there's no access to Oregon courts, new access to Oregon courts granted by this. And that's the most important thing.
So under this version, could the state of Oregon sue the state of Idaho because Idaho has embarked and implements some sort of salmon management plan that affects the certain individual companies in Oregon detrimentally?
Even without this legislation, that could be done, Senator Cohen, because we've got a long-arm statute setting there that's probably very appropriate. Idaho and Washington, you're not going to get anything substantially different
out of
this.
You think it's really primarily international then?
Primarily international, or because of the way just pollution flows. I mean, technically, I guess somebody from Colorado might be able to get access under this, but only if pollution that started in Oregon damaged them in Colorado, and that's... Chances of that happening are fairly slim. As far as our surrounding states, we probably haven't got a long-arm statute problem there.
Okay.
But for Canada, we definitely do. Plus, we have a full faith and credit problem that would mean you'd get nothing out of your Oregon decision against the Canadian defendant. You'd have to go litigate the case all over again in Canada, absent this legislation.
Thank you very much. We'll send
it again. I just want to say there were three work sessions held on this bill last month, and so there might be some information on the House side as well.
Thank you. Thanks very much, folks. Let's hear House Bill 2530. Representative Shiprock is here.
Asking? No. Thank you, Madam Chair. The record, I'm State Representative Bob Shiprock, House District 23, Clackamas County. The other co-sponsor of this bill, Representative Walden, is back in Hood River today, he had to go back home. Very briefly explain House Bill 2530 and why it's in front of you. During the interim, the House Labor Committee had a series of hearings on enforcement and compliance in the construction industry. A large number of very disgruntled builders, particularly from the Mid-Columbia region, came in front of the committee asking us to do something about the rampant noncompliance in the construction industry with various employer taxes, something that I've been working on for several sessions with mixed success. What this bill would do would take, would allow an aggrieved bidder, that's somebody who lost a bid to a successful low bidder, to file a private right of action against that person, and they would then have to prove in court that this person successfully won that low bid by committing, by knowingly and willingly failing to pay certain employer taxes, such as prevailing wages, workers' comp insurance, unemployment insurance taxes, not being registered with the Builders Board, or certain withholding taxes, State Revenue Department withholding income taxes. The House Committee actually, I think, did a better job than the original bill in that they made it simpler to understand. You'd get, if you were successful in that prosecution or action, you get 10% of the total bid amount, or $5,000, whichever is greater. There's also a portion in the end of Section 1 that, and this was, we'll call them the AGC amendments, that made it so that if you were that type of contractor or builder that yourself was not in compliance with Oregon's laws, you could not bring that action. In other words, this is to protect honest bidders who pay their taxes and with various withholdings, and today are hurt quite a bit by being underbid by unscrupulous builders. I didn't have time to copy this, and I apologize for the committee, but I want to explain the problem. During the last three years, we got the Builders Board, Work Comp Department, Employment Division, and the Builders Board to, and the Revenue Department, pardon me, to actually get in a car together and go out on job sites, actually physically inspect job sites. We've been trying to do this for a long time. The results were amazing. I wasn't surprised, but I'd like to share the results of those joint enforcement efforts. They inspected a total of 461 job sites. 9% of the employers had workers' comp insurance problems. Most of them were non-complying. 34% of the employers had questions as to their employment, unemployment taxes. 24% of them had problems with the State Revenue Department, typically paying cash. And 6% of them, in fact, weren't even registered with the board. The areas of the state where they did this vary tremendously, and it's interesting to note that actually it's worse, it appears, in the urban areas, with the exception of Hood River, which is clearly the worst, where these people came from. 30% of the employers in that area were not paying workers' comp. 70% of them were not paying unemployment insurance for their employees. 9% were paying cash, or there were questions of this, and fully 16% of them were not even registered with the board. The Portland area is no better. 38% in Gresham, no workers' comp, and 42% had problems with unemployment insurance. The legitimate contractors of Oregon, frankly, need another tool to try and deal with this. In the competitive area of construction, an employer, where you're working on perhaps a margin of 4 to 5% profit, and you're trying to compete against somebody that's not paying workers' comp, for instance, or paying cash and not withholding taxes, you're not going to compete with those people, and it's getting worse in many instances. The bill, a little bit of historical value, I got the idea from Connecticut. They passed this legislation last year. I was recently told just yesterday that Massachusetts has also passed it, and So those of us in the construction industry are trying to get the word out, and a number of other states are, in fact, in their legislatures this session are looking at this type of legislation. And with that, I'll close and try and take any questions.
Okay, are there questions? Set it from Senator Shipwreck. Thank you very much.
I was supposed to mention something. There may be a typo in this. In line 12, there's a reference to chapter 316. It's not referenced in line 8, but it is referenced in line 10. I'm assuming that's LC Foreman style, but I don't know, and I just wanted to point that out. 316 is, of course, the state revenue chapter, and of course, we'd want to make sure that that's in the bill.
Oh, it's in line 8.
In looking at it again, I think it may be written right, but there was a question as to whether it was or not.
Okay, we'll ask Bill to take a look at that and make sure that the proper notation references are in place. Anyone else who would like to speak with respect to House Bill 2530? Thank you very much. Well, let's just go quickly on to some house to the other 2376. We have one person here on 2376. Trying not to have people wait forever for one single bill, one single individual sign up. 2376, yes, Mr. Calkins.
Well, Wynn Calkins from Eugene. I'm a practicing lawyer and appearing on behalf of the Oregon State Bar Committee, and this is transfer on death securities registration. And it has developed over the years in bank accounts and was adopted in Oregon in 1977, where you could put yourself on your bank account and then pay on death to another person, or POD. And if you had that on your bank account, which you can do today, at your death, the proceeds would automatically be paid to the pay-on-death survivor. That up to this point, that has not been possible to do with stocks and bonds. And this statute is proposed to make that possible by providing a legal vehicle by which transfer agents are comfortable in following the customer's wishes and listing it as, instead of POD, it would be TOD, which would be transfer on death, since it's not a bank account out of which funds are paid, but transfer on death, the securities listed in that name. The bill was drafted on a national level with the input of the banking community and the transfer agents, and it has already been enacted in a number of states, and it did receive input from a number of bar committees, and to my knowledge, there's no opposition to it. Basically, the purpose of the act is to provide enough legal comfort to the stock transfer agents to allow customers to do this. By passing this uniformly across the country, transfer agents will be given the legal vehicle to offer this to customers. Basically, I've submitted written testimony reviewing this, and I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Thank you. Are there questions?
One question. Section 7 speaks of owners holding their interests as tenants in common, that is, multiple beneficiaries holding their interests as tenants in common. I guess it is true that stock can be owned as tenants in common?
Yes, mm-hmm. They can now.
Okay, then that leads me to my question, which is the next sentence that says if no beneficiary survives the death of all owners, the security belongs to the estate of the deceased, to the estate of the last to die of all multiple owners. Does that mean that a tenancy in common then becomes a right of survivorship?
No. I think what you're speaking of, the sentence, until division of the security after the death of all owners, multiple beneficiaries surviving the death of all owners hold their interests as tenants in common.
Right.
That only refers to the pay-on-death beneficiaries.
I understand that
hold
part.
As tenants
right.
in common if they're just listed a group of them until the point of distribution. So that doesn't change current law
that,
with respect...
That, I would just ask that question to make sure that stock could be held in common.
Yes.
And my real question is in the next sentence when it says, I read it right, mm-hmm. if there are no beneficiaries, then the security belongs to the estate of the last to die of all multiple owners.
Okay.
Now, if the stock is owned in common, it wouldn't go by survivorship. It would be an undivided interest. This seems to say that that tenancy in common is converted to a survivorship situation. I'm sure that's not what's intended.
In order to understand this, you need to go back to the definition of Section 1, parens 1, of beneficiary form, and then go through Section 3, registration and beneficiary form. And if you go through those, you'll find that in order to register in beneficiary form,